Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. The South Carolina surge for George W. this weekend may have ended John McCain's insurgency. W. managed to co-opt McCain's message of reform and beat him black and blue with Republican votes. And he managed to start a kind of insurgency of his own to get old-fashioned Republicans fired up to take the party back from the moderates and the mavericks. The Michigan primary tomorrow is the last big contest for a while in which independents and Democrats can vote. John McCain needs to win there to refuel his campaigns for New York and California on March 7th. The hindsight questions now, a sort of George Bush questions addressed to John McCain. Can he get up off the floor? Can he focus his anger effectively? Then there are particular McCain questions, too. Was this Republican insurgency a passing fancy? Or was it a fancy pass inspired mainly by a media that never much loved the Republican establishment anyway? We're talking about round three of the Republican primary contest this hour. Connection listeners, what do you hear in those South Carolina results? Are you giving George W. a second look? Does it matter who's the better candidate for a November election? 1-800-423-8255. For 1-800-423-TALK makes the connection with Bill Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard out of Washington. And joining us from Michigan, Bill Ballinger, editor of Inside Michigan Politics. Bill Ballinger, who's going to win in Michigan tomorrow and why?
I tend to think at this point George W. Bush is going to win. Before South Carolina, I thought John McCain had a very good chance. I'm doubtful about that now.
What's the lineup in Michigan?
Well, the lineup is that McCain is up in Traverse City. Bush is down in Detroit. They're frantically racing around the state during the next 24 hours just to try and basically get their vote out, energize their base. That's all they have time to do. The fact of the matter is time is running out. The clock is working against John McCain at this point. He doesn't have nearly 3 weeks to recover from a defeat, as George W. Bush did after New Hampshire and South Carolina. He's got to turn it around in 36 hours, and he doesn't have the infrastructure here to be able to do that very efficiently. So
the infrastructure in South Carolina, I mean, from Strom Thurmond on down, the Civil War crowd to the religious right was all immensely powerfully engaged for George Bush. John Engler is famously for George Bush, too. I mean, is there any beating that the party machine?
Oh, absolutely. The establishment here is pretty much rock solid for George W. Bush, has been from the beginning. John McCain did get a big boost here at the end of last week, endorsement from former Governor Bill Milliken, a moderate Republican who is a revered figure here, actually crossing party lines, and who ironically was the man who lifted George W. Bush's father to a big upset victory over Ronald Reagan 2 decades ago in the Michigan primary, but has now deserted the Bush family for John McCain. Nevertheless, he's about the only big figure that John McCain has in his corner, and the real issue is whether or not the independent and Democratic turnout here, which many people think will be substantial as a percentage of the electorate, perhaps as high as South Carolina, is going to be enough to offset what looks to be a widening gap within the Republican Party between Bush and McCain, exactly the same phenomenon we saw in South Carolina. It's almost a zero-sum game. As fast as McCain can lure independents and Democrats to vote on Tuesday for him, the Republicans gain, Republicans who would otherwise sit at home and don't want to see their party nomination hijacked by outsiders, or gets Republicans who are going to vote anyway to convert or switch from being for McCain to being for Bush.
I want to come back to you, Bill Ballinger, on the matter of the independents, but I've got to draw Bill Kristol in here. Bill Kristol, what did happen in South Carolina? You wrote that, or you were quoted saying that the compassionate conservative, George Bush, became the cutthroat conservative. My sense is that the fight became a war in South Carolina.
It did, and I don't buy the argument, frankly, that, George Bush sold himself successfully as a reformer. Obviously, people decided to be for Bush and then decided that he was as much of a reformer as McCain. It sounds good to be a reformer. If you ask people leaving the polling booth, they'll say, and they voted for someone, and they ask him whether he's a reformer or not, they'll say yes. The truth is, Bush crushed McCain in South Carolina with a huge negative assault, a lot of it below the radar screen. particularly targeted at religious conservatives. Now, that's politics. That's fair. It's fair if the assault is honest and truthful, which some of it was and some of it wasn't. A lot of that depends on whether you believe that there's a serious ideological difference between Bush and McCain, or, which I don't, frankly, or whether you believe that Bush positioned himself as the true conservative and somehow more pro-life, for example, than McCain. And I think that's basically what's happening in Michigan. The fact is, the polls started, as Bill Ballinger knows better than I, the polls started to turn for Bush last week, even before South Carolina. They started to turn, I gather, from reading some of the Michigan press, particularly in Western Michigan, where there was a huge pro-life mailing done into Western Michigan, a very pro-life part of the state, which attacked John McCain's pro-life credentials. I would argue pretty unfairly. Both Bush and McCain are pro-life. Both of them are not as strongly pro-life as someone like me, for example, would prefer, but that's the way they are. But to pretend that there's a big difference between them is, I think, a little ridiculous. The big danger is not so much that Bush has gone too far right for the general, from a Republican point of view, I think, but that the negative campaign, the assault on behalf of the establishment, on behalf of Bush, has tarnished the sense that Bush is a fresh face, a new, youthful, different Republican face from 1992 and 1996 and 1998, different from Dole, different from Gingrich. And I'm, as a Republican, frankly, very worried that we're now, if Bush is the nominee, you end up going into November 2000 with a repeat of the Bush 92 or Dole 96 campaigns.
Well, but let's not forget the baggage that he's taken on in South Carolina. I mean, Strom Thurmond and all that. That's that counts too, doesn't it?
Yeah, it counts. I think my only point I'm making, Christopher, and I'm not, the baggage is less. It's less that it's that conservative. It's more that it's negative, I think, and old and tired.
We took on Lee Atwater as well as Strom Thurmond.
Well, Lee Atwater won a lot. Lee Atwater won a lot of national campaigns. You know, when he died, the Bush. He won the Bush campaign. He ran, and Bush lost after Lee died. I mean, I look. I'm not quarreling with you. I think Bob Jones is a bad thing. Bad association to have up north. On the other hand, we're, you know, 8-9 months from the general election. Al Gore's with Al Sharpton today in New York. That's a pretty bad association to have with a lot of independent moderate voters too. So both parties are going to obviously try to, you know, minimize the damaging associations they have on their fringes. As I say, I think the deeper damage is less that, which is kind of what always happens in a primary campaign, and more the sense Bush succeeded in 99 in looking like a fresh face. That's why he was ahead of Gore by 15 points in these polls. It did not look like Bush 92 and Dole 96. And the question, I think, for the general election is, if Bush is to be the nominee, which I'm not certain about, let me come back to that in a second, but if Bush is to be the nominee, can he recapture some of the freshness? Can he really take some of the McCain message, some of the McCain appeal to independents, and co-opt it for himself? Just on the Michigan situation tomorrow, again, Bill is obviously there on the ground, and the one thing we've learned is it's very hard to read these states from outside. I think we saw that with New Hampshire and South Carolina. The truth is we read the national press. Maybe we go up on the web and read some of the local papers, but you need to be there to experience what an average voter is learning, what information he's getting from both paid TV, free TV, radio, direct mail, telephone calls, and the like. So I don't really know what it's like to be a swing voter in the Detroit suburbs or in the Grand Rapids suburbs. Having said that, you know, you never know. This has been a very unpredictable season. Obviously, Bush has momentum, and presumably, if he's even now, he'll win by a few points or maybe by more than a few points. On the other hand, you could imagine a little bit of a rebellion among voters in Michigan against the notion that South Carolina gets to determine the Republican nominee, that Pat Robertson and those guys weigh in big in South Carolina, and everyone in Michigan says, oh, okay, I guess Bush is the guy we have to vote for. So you could imagine a little bit of a snap, as South Carolina snapped back against New Hampshire, in a sense, you know, being from
right.
You could imagine a bit of a snapback in Michigan against South Carolina, I think.
Bill Kristol, I want to pick you up, though, on this matter of the techniques here, including the phone banks. I mean, you spoke of a sort of below-the-radar and maybe below-the-belt campaign by George Bush. I wish you and Bill Ballinger would both spell out just exactly how this works. I mean, it sounds like these sort of probably computer-dialed phone messages from Barbara Bush or Pat Robertson were extremely important in South Carolina.
Here's the reason I think they were is that you know who the, I mean, just as an empirical matter, the skew between sort of religious conservatives, and especially in the northern part of the state, in South Carolina, which is the Bible Belt part of the state, and, you know, other voters, including other Republican voters down on the coast, is so great that obviously something moved the vote. And since the TV commercials were kind of everywhere, I think it's fair to say, just again, speaking kind of analytically in a political science way here, that what moved the vote was probably a little more the mail, the phone calls, and the radio. I mean, I'll be brief and let Bill speak to this too. You know, look, there are different levels of ways to communicate with voters in campaigns, and they're all legitimate. They're just different. TV is the most visible. You put up a TV ad, it gets commented on. If in McCain's case, it got commented on negatively in South Carolina, and he had to pull it down. Radio is a little less visible. You can target that more. You can do more niche radio advertising. You go on Christian radio, you go on black radio, obviously, in a Democratic primary, that kind of thing, ethnic radio. The mails is even more below the radar screen. You send letters to certain lists of voters. You know, NPR listeners in Boston would probably not be a great mailing list for a conservative, you know, Republican candidate and the like. And telephoning with these recorded calls or with people calling, individuals, volunteers, or paid callers calling, is obviously even more perhaps targeted. You don't have a record of it the way you do with a letter that's been mailed out. And it's clear that in the mail and in the telephoning in South Carolina, there was a huge assault on McCain. Now, that's fair enough if it's honest, and most of it, you know, a lot of it was legitimate on issues, on votes, on McCain's supporters. I mean, you know, fine, Warren Rubin's for McCain. If Warren Rubin said X, Y, and Z about the Christian Coalition, I suppose it's fair to mail Christian Coalition voters a letter saying, hey, Warren Rubin's a big buddy of McCain's, and Warren Rubin trashed the Christian Coalition. On the other hand, some of the stuff that went on, especially in the telephoning, was genuinely below the belt, real personal attacks on Senator and Mrs. McCain, and also just falsehoods in the sense that they misrepresented his record. So, you know, as always in the campaign, it's a bit of a mix. But I do think that negative assault had a pretty big effect in South Carolina.
Bill Ballinger, what do you hear in Michigan?
Well, I can tell you, I'm trying to be an objective, nonpartisan observer here. I have gotten one mailing. We're talking about targeted mailings and targeted phone calls, Bill Kristol mentioned. One mailing, I actually got two of them from Governor John Engler Thursday. I ended up on one of his mailing lists, in which he basically is encouraging, dear friend, the Democrats and independents are trying to hijack our primary. I'm concerned Republicans aren't getting out and voting. Please get out and vote. Then an attached sheet with all sorts of quotes from various publications depicting John McCain as almost the devil incarnate, certainly a liberal, labor-backed, Al Gore-like stalking horse, Trojan horse within the Republican Party. And then a third sheet with a list of all the county phone bank chairmen for George W. Bush in all 83 counties of Michigan. Now, that was the Engler mailing. Now, I've gotten one phone call, and guess what? That was an automatic voice-recorded phone call from an organization saying, if you're a Democrat or an independent voter, you can vote in the Republican primary, and it will not disenfranchise you to go and vote in the Democratic caucuses on March 11th. And you can vote for John McCain. Thank you very much. Click. Now, there's what I've gotten. You talk about below radar. Those are below radar, as Bill Kristol was describing it, in the sense that they're not open, accessible to everybody in the general public like radio or especially TV. So that is the kind of stuff that's going on. There is much more of it being done by George W. Bush because he has more money. There are all sorts of negative ads being run constantly in the Detroit area for the last 2 weeks, obviously trying to depress voter turnout potentially from independents and Democrats, maybe trying to discourage them from getting involved and also to try and convert Republicans who are on the bubble to vote for George W. Bush and not John McCain.
Could I ask you both, and maybe starting with you, Bill Kristol, it seems to me the enormously underreported always is the weight of the party establishment. And I mean it at the state level. A guy like John Engler is an enormously powerful position against insurgencies. We also just forget how parties, more than anything, they'd rather take a defeat than an insurgency. It took the Democrats, you know, the Vietnam War and Eugene McCarthy, Robert Kennedy lost to the Hubert Humphrey forces, Lyndon Johnson forces in 1968. It took years and years and a terribly divisive war to leverage their their insurgency to victory in the party. The Republicans had no experience, no modern experience of honoring something like what McCain's trying to pull off. It seems to me he's out on a very, very precarious limb. Bill Kristol?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I'll let Bill Ballinger talk about Engler in particular. I'm a little skeptical of the governors per se. Engler's one of the stronger ones, one of the more politically adept ones, in my view, and has more of a machine than most Republican governors. I'm still doubtful that they can resist much of a popular tide. I would broaden your point. I think you're right when you take your point more broadly, which is the establishment in general has a lot of weight. And what Bush succeeded in uniting behind him, and in a way McCain's insurgency succeeded in uniting behind Bush, are almost all the different establishments that make up the Republican Party. That is to say, you've got the conservative sort of think tank establishment, not think tank, the conservative establishment. You've got Rush Limbaugh, you've got the Wall Street Journal editorial page, you've got George Will, who are all Cal Thomas, the most widely syndicated conservative columnist. They're all basically for Bush. You've got the business establishment, the corporate types are for Bush. You've got the religious conservative establishment, Pat Robertson, Ralph Reed. Now, in each case, interestingly, and this is why I think it's not primarily an ideological matter, you've got rebels who have the same views as those people being more or less for McCain. You know, Gary Bauer is not more or less liberal than Ralph Reed. He has a different take on politics somehow. He's more of a rebel. You know, Ralph wants a seat at the table with the power brokers. Gary wants to kick over the table. And again, both are legitimate, I think, points of view. They're maybe temperamental and sort of ultimately kind of philosophical differences in terms of how you ultimately advance your agenda. But I think you're right. The establishment is really banded behind Bush. McCain perhaps has made some tactical errors. One trouble with an insurgency is you sort of have to pull it off perfectly for it to work because you have so much less in the way of resources and so much less to fall back on. Whether he can make it work or not this time, I don't know. The odds are against him. I do believe, as in your example of McCarthy, McGovern, Bobby Kennedy, that there's something there that can't be suppressed forever. I mean, I'm a Republican, but I think there's something sort of rotten at the heart of the Republican Party and at the conservative and something weak at the and sort of out of touch about the conservative establishment. And I think the insurgency will break through at some point. It may not make it in 2000.
Well, let's just talk about it. You made an interesting list there of the kinds of people that are with George Bush. You're with John McCain in the Weekly Standard. That's sort of the memory of Newt Gingrich. It's the power of Rupert Murdoch. Bill Sapphire on the Times op-ed page out of the Nixon White House is with John McCain. Former Governor Milliken in Michigan is with John McCain. Give us a sketch of the kinds of folk and the kinds of reasons the people are in the McCain camp.
Well, people have their own reasons, and people, some people are really in the camp, and others are sort of fellow travelers. I would say the troublemakers are with McCain, and the more orthodox establishment types are with Bush. And I'm struck when you see it across the board. I was reading something in the paper this morning in California. For example, the former head of the Howard Jarvis taxpayer kind of rebellion movement is from McCain. Now, think about it for a minute. This is a guy who has spent a huge amount of volunteer and citizen sort of active life fighting for lower taxes. Bush is the one with a larger tax cut, wisely or unwisely, than McCain. Yet this guy, who obviously bucked the Republican establishment in California, is with McCain. And I think a lot of it has to do with a sense, again, less of an ideological sense and more of a sense. And in this respect, it's not that Sapphire was in the Nixon White House or that My Magazine is owned by Rupert Murdoch. It's more, is your sense, I mean, if you have the sense that the establishment is in pretty good shape, the party's in pretty good shape, the conservative movement's in pretty good shape, the only problem in 92 and 96 was we had kind of not such good candidates, and all we need to do is get Bush nominated, and then he can beat Gore, and everything will be fine, then you should be for Bush, because he'll advance the moderate conservative agenda. If you think the problem is deeper, if you think there's a real problem with reaching out to moderates and independents, if you think that the conservative message is sort of out of touch, then you're inclined to be for McCain, even if you don't agree with him, as I don't, on every issue. So it's a little hard, as with all these insurgencies, it's a little hard to put your finger on. Think of, you mentioned 68, Christopher. Hubert Humphrey was a liberal. I mean, Bobby Kennedy was not to the left of Hubert Humphrey in any simple sense on most issues. Vietnam became a big dividing line, but you can make a case that if you look back over their political careers, as you know, Hubert Humphrey was more consistently liberal than Bobby Kennedy, after all, in the early 60s.
No, it's ins and outs. It's who owns the machine and who's trying to rattle it.
Exactly. A lot of it is who you're with and who your friends are and what your candidacy comes to represent and embody, almost more than any particular position you've taken.
Absolutely. Bill Ballinger.
Yeah, let me just mention, John Engler, when you talk about governors and the establishment of Michigan, I mean, his relationship with the Bush family goes way back to 1980 when John Engler's first wife was actually the deputy Michigan chairman for the George Bush the Father campaign for the presidency against Ronald Reagan in 1980 and helped Bush upset Reagan on May 25th of that year, 2-1, huge victory in Michigan. And of course, again, this is a key thing. Engler is a governor. Bush is a governor. You know, Engler is the champion of the governors as the center of the political universe.
Right.
Every time he's on national television, this is what he talks up. He points out constantly, he's doing it here in Michigan, and Bush is echoing this, that, you know, we are executives, we're in charge, we set the agenda, we make things happen. John McCain is just a legislator, and to make things worse, he's a Washington legislator, and he can get up and rail and flail his arms about reform, but what has he ever done?
Right.
We get it done. I mean, this is part of the agenda. I agree with something that Bill Kristol said much earlier, and that is, real questions about whether George W. Bush is ever going to be able to demonstrate between now and November any kind of crossover appeal to independents and Democrats. I gotta tell you, John McCain's appeal to independents and Democrats, swing voters in this state, is something I haven't seen by a Republican in, you know, since Bill Milliken is a governor, let's say, and he left office in 1982. First time I've seen it in two decades. It is phenomenal.
Hmm.
And ironically...
Well, in South Carolina, that, of course, worked heavily against him.
Well, just think of this. I mean,
the turnout, supposedly
39% combined Democrats and independents down there. 30% independents, 9% Democrats. And, I mean, McCain killed Bush among those people. The problem was that Bush ended up winning the Republican voters, who constituted about 61%, about 2-1 by 30 points, whereas all the early polls there showed that he had, after New Hampshire, maybe only a 10 to 15% margin, then a 20% margin, and ended up being a 30% margin. That's what killed McCain. Here in Michigan, I see the same kind of phenomenon developing. This is like a macrocosm of South Carolina, in the sense we're a bigger state, a more diverse state, yes, all those things, but the same phenomenon is developing. The problem is that George W. Bush, to me, has not demonstrated any ability to reach out. He's not moving ahead now in the polls because he's capturing more independents or swing voters or Democrats. He's simply getting more from the Christian right here in Michigan, which, yes, isn't as big as it is in South Carolina, but it's still very important, and from traditional Republican voters who are worried about their party's nomination being hijacked. And I don't see George W. Bush as being the kind of fresh-faced, compassionate conservative that he presented himself as being in the beginning. I agree with Bill Kristol. I think that you got to remember a lot of George W. Bush's early appeal and the standing in the polls vis-a-vis Al Gore a year ago was all based on the fact his name was Bush, and people didn't really even know who they were talking about. They were waiting for the outline to be filled in. Now it's being filled in. And in my estimation, it's not being filled in a very pretty way for the Republican Party.
Bill Ballinger, stand by, and Bill Kristol, too, for callers, 1-800-423-8255, the Landscape After South Carolina connection, 1-800-423-TALK. Justin is calling from Suffolk, Virginia. Hello, Justin.
Hello.
Welcome.
The big thing about South Carolina that kind of gets me is, you know, they keep talking that it was such a big victory for Bush, but, I mean, Bush outspent McCain by, you know, 8 or 9 to 1. And as an independent myself...
In South Carolina, I don't think so, Justin.
Well,
10 to 1, it doesn't sound right.
Well, and the other thing that bothered me about South Carolina as an independent is when Bush went to Bob Jones University. And I think that a lot of the independent voters and the Republicans who are Catholics are going to notice that.
In Michigan, you're talking about?
No, in South Carolina, Bush went and spoke at Bob Jones University.
Sure, right.
Which is, you know, and they're very, that university is very anti-Catholic, anti-Pope, anti-Catholic. And I think that that's going to have an effect on Catholic Republicans.
Bill Kristol? How long are we going to be hearing about Bob Jones?
I don't know. I'm going to hop off here in a couple of minutes, so I'll give you this one thought. And the just like I've got to go to an editorial meeting. The we could be hearing about, believe me, the Democratic National Committee has footage of Bush at Bob Jones and has footage of people raising the question of why he didn't go out of his way to disavow the racial policies there and the anti-Catholicism of Bob Jones III and some of the statements he's made. I think it's a problem with swing Catholics in the North, the Reagan Democrats who came over and some of whom stayed as Republicans, some of whom go back and forth between being Democrats and Republicans. On the spending issue, which the caller raised, I think it was about, if you add up the TV and the mail and the phones, probably 2 or 3 to 1 in South Carolina, a little hard. If you count the pro-Bush expenditures that were not attached to the campaign, it's probably more like 3 to 1, which, look, is a big advantage. And the funny, I mean, I get Bill Ballinger made an important point. Well, we need to, if you're a Republican and I am, you know, how good a candidate is George W. Bush? I mean, he was anointed in 99. That was nice. He's very charming to Republican donors. That was nice. Republican grassroots people look up at him, and he's a Bush, and he's a good guy, and he seems like he's a successful governor of Texas. That's fine. Now we get in a real campaign with punches and counterpunches. Right. How has he done? Miserably in New Hampshire, obviously. Well, that's a little exceptional because McCain spent 110 town meetings there or whatever. South Carolina, all these advantages he has, outspends his opponent 3 to 1, has the support of the entire establishment down there, wins by 11 points. Now, from the point of view of the campaign dynamics, winning by 11 points was probably enough and was probably crucial. And if it leads him to victory in Michigan, he probably gets the nomination. But if you step back and you say a year, you know, half a year ago, George W. Bush, a Southern governor against John McCain, an outside maverick Arizona senator, give Bush a 3 to 1 spending advantage. How much should he win by in South Carolina? I think if you're me or Bill Ballinger or any political, or you, Christopher, or anyone who follows politics, you know, you say he wins 2 to 1, right? I mean, that's.
I gotta say thank you to Bill Kristol. We gotta take a short break, Bill. Thank you enormously for joining us. This is The Connection. We'll be back. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
From Boston University,
I'm Christopher Ledden. This is The Connection, the Republican Tong War Connection. After South Carolina, 1-800-423-8255 is inevitable. George Bush, who became inevitable in New Hampshire, is he inevitable again? 1-800-423-TALK is the phone. Robert Shogan is on the line, longtime political correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, whose name became synonymous with the Shogun rule. The rule was the candidate that the reporters fall in love with cannot win. Whether his name is Gene McCarthy or Mo Udall or maybe even John McCain. Robert Shogun, how does the Shogun rule apply to John McCain now?
Well, it's another variation of what has been true through history. It shouldn't really be surprising that politicians who are admired by the media don't go off well by the general public when it just has to stop and think of how the media are viewed by the general public. They're held, I don't think, with the exception of used car dealers, I don't know any group of people who are held in lower esteem. So stands to the reason that that kind of popularity isn't transferable. But there's some more to it than that. I think the reason that politicians like McCain and his fellow Arizonan, Mo Udall, and also...
Barry Goldwater. Reporters came to love Barry Goldwater. Well, they like Bob Dole, too.
That's right. Well, because the reason reporters like these guys is because they offer a kind of a mixture of candor and humor. And these are appealing to reporters who like to see themselves as kind of sophisticated and humorous fellows and women. And unfortunately, candor and humor don't necessarily, or in fact, rarely go over with the general populace. To illustrate and go back a little in history, but I know that a politician that you would remember, some of our listeners, our younger listeners might not, you remember President Gilligan? President John Gilligan of Ohio?
Well,
of course, he didn't quite make it to the White House, although a lot of reporters thought that he was a sure shot because Gilligan was clever and quick and funny and kind of acerbic. And I remember And the story about Gilligan, when he was governor of Ohio, he did actually get to be governor. The presidency turned out to be kind of a fantasy on the part of a lot of people in the so-called Fourth Estate. At any rate, Governor Gilligan went to a county fair, of which there are many in Ohio, and he went to one of the booths. They were fleecing the sheep. And a reporter asked him, well, what do you think of this, Governor? And he said, it reminds me of what we're going to do to the taxpayers next year. Well, reporters around him thought that was uproarious, so much so that they practically ruined Gilligan by printing the story. And Governor Gilligan not only didn't get to be President Gilligan, he got to be ex-Governor Gilligan in the next election. So,
well,
there you go.
John McCain hasn't said anything desperately unfortunate on the Straight Talk Express, though, but it has become what some people call the love bus, and you wonder...
it's kind of a self-defeating situation for a politician, because to get back to this candor thing, is that the reporters praise him for being candid or seeming to be candid. In fact, the guy in this situation, like other men, and I imagine there must be women politicians like that, although no one comes immediately to mind, certainly not Ms. Rodham. But at any rate, they praise him for being honest and candid and sincere. Well, you try and carry that out into the hustings, as we say, or try and talk to millions of people who have conflicting interests, and you find yourself, if you're a politician, trimming about the edges. So what do you know? The next day, George W. Bush is out there calling you a damned hypocrite. And so that's the trouble with candor, is that it invites, it invites refutation. It's pretty hard to stay up. I noticed that there's a whole flurry of stories now in the print press and on the air criticizing McCain for not being what we and the media thought he was. There's some criticism, I won't mention it before, that said that his record in the legislature is summed up more by what he wanted to do than by what he accomplished. Now, I don't know who that could... Do we know of any politician whose accomplishments exceeded what he wanted to do? I mean, that's kind of a perverse way of doing it, but it's the famous counter-trend story. You know, there are two devils in political journalism, about which I'm writing another book that will come out this fall, or next year, actually. It's called The Enablers: How the press aids and abets the abuse of presidential politics. But one part of the one dangerous trend is PAC journalism, which you and I are familiar with, although we would never run with the PAC, huh? But that's where all...
Not me, buddy.
No, not me, babe. But what we all did was, of course, we ran with the same story for a couple of reasons. One, because it was probably a pretty good story. Also, because we were afraid not to, because our editors would call up and say, you know, how come you haven't got what Chris Lydon's got in the New York Times? So that's PAC journalism, and that's very insidious. We can all see that, because it's a mindless pursuit of the same obvious truth. The obverse and reverse of PAC journalism is the counter-trend story, in which once a conceit gets to be conventional wisdom, then the media turn on it and try and refute it and undercut it. And so you have everyone going, you and I never did that either, did we? So you and I sort of go around, we become the great debunkers of the world. And so between PAC journalism and the counter trend story, the other kind of you have two devil in the deep blue sea.
There's also something like the Sports Illustrated curse here. I mean, no boxer, no tennis star, no, especially individual athlete, wants to be in the cover of Sports Illustrated before the big test.
Yeah, I suppose. And McCain became popular too soon. Well, of course, I don't think it's quite as true in, may not be necessarily be as true in presidential politics as it is in the world of sports. Because as it happened, Bill Clinton was on the cover of both national news magazines in 92. Actually, I think in either early 92 or late 91, before a New Hampshire primary. Now, of course, all kinds of bad things befell him, but he did get nominated and did get elected twice, it seems. So there's the counter trend, see, to the theory.
Bob Shulgin, your last book called The Double-Edged Sword was all about character.
Yes, presidential character.
Yeah. Do you want to make some character observations here on the McCain-Bush contest?
Well, yeah, first of all, I'd like to say, and it should be unnecessary to say this, but all the Clintonians, and that is to say the defenders of the great prevaricator in the White House, have tried to make us convinced that character doesn't matter, that it really that it's meaningless, that all we want is the man doing public duty. I mean, the argument that I would make, based going back to George Washington, is that it's impossible to separate a guy's personality, his integrity, his morality, all these qualities that we think making up character, with the way he carries out his job, particularly as president, because it's a job in which, as we all know, guy combines being chief of state, chief of government, so on and so forth. Well, what I argue in the book, and based on history, and starting with Washington to the present time, is that the way a guy is bent, and that's particularly after the description, I guess, for Clinton, it tells you a lot about, personally, how he's going to discharge his duties as government. And, of course, that's true. Clinton is true for a lot of other people. Now, it is true of McCain and Bush, although we don't know as much about them yet, but we have seen various aspects develop just in this crucible of campaign that's only a few months old. We've seen Bush react, how did he react to pressure? Well, he got his comeuppance in New Hampshire, and he reacted by striking out very vehemently at his antagonist. George Bush didn't go back and say, what the hell have I done wrong? Was I saying enough? He just went after McCain and kicked the hell out of him in South Carolina. And he was able to accomplish that. He has more money, more muscle, and is better known, particularly in the state of South Carolina. Now, that allowed him to win South Carolina. But it also allowed, we got to see a different side of Bush's character and of his political persona, and the side we saw is not consistent with what he tried to tell us about himself, is it? Which is that he's a unifier, not a divider. He won in California by dividing the people, by dividing the electorate sharply between conservatives and real Republicans against the rest, who were against McCain. Now, McCain is an interesting kind of guy who, again, candor is what he has to sell. And what he's saying is that, I'm the genuine article, and what you see is what you get. And that's a very affecting person, and it's a mask, but it may be too true in his case, because what we've seen is that he's kind of impulsive, isn't it? Now, he got his backup in South Carolina. He wouldn't blame him when Bush lined up those stooges of his to lambaste McCain and say that he'd let down the prisoners of the missing in actions in Vietnam after he got home. And McCain was really stung. And instead of sitting down and saying to himself, this son of a bitch must really be desperate to come after me like that, he went after him and called him and compared him, well, not him exactly, there to Clinton. And I mean, I think that tells really all we need to know about presidential character, where Bush, in effect, his Trump issue in the South Carolina primary was to claim he had been defamed because his opponent had compared him to the incumbent president who's twice been elected. So, I mean, what does that tell us about, what character means? And no one challenged that. No one said, well, that's not so bad being compared to Clinton. I mean, it would be interesting if how Gore would feel if he used an ad like that.
Bob Shulgin, stand by. Bob Shulgin. Later, the L.A. Times, inventor of the Shogun rule that if the press loves you, the people will turn against you. 1-800-423-8255, the between Michigan and South Carolina connection. Greg is on the line.
Hi, great show, Chris.
Thank you, Greg.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
I'm calling to ask about religion as it affects John McCain, because clearly he's not well-beloved by the Christian right. Now, I'm curious about in terms of Catholics, even in terms of Jews and Muslims. Now, if, say, George Bush is a very religious man, does he believe all these potential voters are going to go to hell?
Well, you mean all the voters, I'm sorry, you mean all the people who voted for McCain are going to go to hell?
Well, no. People who do not accept Jesus Christ as the only way to have life. Because I know people have been bandying about religion very easily. Al Gore's talked about it. McCain seems to keep his religion more close to the vest.
Well, I don't know what he believes about that, and I doubt that he would say that. I suppose he would try and put it the other way, is that people who accept his candidacy as embodying some measure of divine wisdom have taken a good step in the direction of heaven. But I think he probably would say that. I don't know that he would. I think Bush, like most politicians, wouldn't want to write off anybody by putting him in purgatory. Unless there were a primary there, you know, maybe he thought he had a chance at winning that. I don't know.
Greg, thank you. I want to bring Bill Ballinger back, editor of the Inside Michigan Politics newsletter. Bill, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
I just want to come back to this question of incumbents. You outlined the Engler worldview very succinctly, it seemed to me. Governors are the center of the universe. The state parties must prevail. John McCain is a gadfly, a real true pain in the neck. Bill Kristol raised the question, you know, whether George Bush is the strongest candidate in November. My observation of these things over a lot of years is that, first of all, voters, particularly in the throes of a political crush, don't think about November. Secondly, people like John Engler think of November and they say, we'd rather lose to the Democrat in the final than have our party tipped over here in Michigan by an outsider like John McCain. That this, we're, you know, the discussion of American politics greatly overemphasizes character questions, ideological matters, and underplays the fact that there are the ins defending the fortress against the outs.
Yeah, I would only say about John Engler, honestly, to give him credit, he is a real party regular.
Yep.
And he would not desert John McCain, in my view, if John McCain should become the nominee. He certainly wouldn't be working as hard for him, perhaps, and killing himself, doing everything possible to elect him as much as he would with George W. Bush. But he would bite the bullet, swallow hard, and for John. We saw this in 1998 when John Engler tried to get Scott Romney, son of a former governor, nominated for attorney general at a party convention and was rebuffed in a shocking move by the Republican convention delegates here in Michigan, and they nominated somebody else. John Engler was humiliated by that defeat and yet did campaign for John Smetanka, who was the Republican nominee, did and said all the right things, got money out there early for Smetanka in ads that when Smetanka himself did not have the money. So I don't think that John Engler is a good example of a member of the establishment who says it's either my way or the highway, and if we can't have our nominee, we just as soon lose in November. I don't think he'd feel that way. I think one of the ironies of this whole situation is that John McCain, as Bill Kristol pointed out earlier, is actually not far away from George W. Bush on all these culturally and socially conservative issues. I mean, he really has an almost pristine voting record on the issues on abortion, for instance, that are most important to social conservatives. So, and yet he has this crossover appeal because of the character, personal life story side of him and because of his reform message that George W. Bush does not have. So it's really a phenomenal situation. It is Reagan-esque in the sense that he does have a social, cultural profile not that far away from Ronald Reagan's, but he has a message that does carry some appeal to people who are non-Republicans. And yet, the establishment fails to recognize this or take advantage of it, and they are sticking with somebody who, in my view, simply represents a kind of a pale imitation of his father, who was rejected by the national electorate 8 years ago.
Bill Ballinger, stand by. 1-800-423-8255, the On the Way to Michigan connection. Nandor is on the line.
Hey, just to give you some background where I'm coming from, I voted for Ralph Nader in the last election, but right now I think John McCain is the best candidate among both of the major parties. And it's really unfortunate that he lost South Carolina and will probably lose Michigan. I think to the one fact is that he let George Bush come out and say that he's the real reformer. I mean, you know, that he's a reformer with results. I mean, where that's Bush's biggest weakness. I mean, Bush has said one of Bush's quips is, my zip code is in Texas. But, I mean, Bush's money is from zip code is in Washington. I mean, he's the consummate insider, you know, working on his father's campaign.
Well, as Bill Kristol said, Nando, I mean, people didn't vote for George Bush because he's a reformer. That was kind of a label that was put after the fact on an establishment victory, and that's politics, I think. 1-800-423-8255 is the connection phone. John is calling from Portsmouth, Virginia.
Great show, as usual.
Thank you, John.
I would be I couldn't vote for a Republican in this area because of the movement of the Supreme Court back to the 19th century, and I wouldn't want to encourage that. But I have a quick quiz on the character issue. If you had three candidates for war leader, one was drank a fifth of whiskey a day, but almost got kicked out of college for smoking opium, and one drank 8 to 10 martinis a day, had a couple of affairs, and the third one was a teetotaler who was a war hero and rarely drank lightly. Which one would the Republican Party choose for a candidate?
That's
the first one, of course, is Churchill. The second one is Roosevelt, and the third one is Adolf Hitler.
Bob Shogan, you're our character judge here.
That takes care of the character issue as far as that goes. Yeah, you threw in Benjamin Franklin and all the rest of the guys.
Well, I think we'd have to know. I think we'd have to know how many packs a day they smoke in order to really tell their character. I think they're talking about character, what motivates politicians. I wanted to go back, Chris, to something you were talking about with Bill Ballinger and Engler. I think the question is not whether Engler would support Engler and his ilk, and they're all for Bush, whether they would support McCain if he got nominated. Probably they would. The question really is, why are they moving heaven and earth to stop that from happening? And the reason is not necessarily is because they themselves have committed to Bush. They made a decision some time ago, for whatever reason, that they were going to back him. They've got a lot at stake here. What they care about now mostly is not who wins this election. And it's really not George Bush. It's their own prestige and their own political future. These governors do not, and senators and county chairmen, do not want to be humiliated. Power and prestige is very important to them. They've put a stake behind George Bush. They hope to benefit from it. And right now they see themselves as big losers if McCain were to beat him, regardless of what the vote is in November. And that's what matters to them. And look to people's self-interest to understand why they behave.
I agree with that 100%.
I do too, Bob Shogan. It's very well said, although I would just say it's less about prestige than it is about power.
Well, prestige is part of power. You know, it's part of power.
Well, that's the least of it.
Yeah.
I just want to invoke a book you probably know. It was kind of a cult book among political reporters called Indispensable Enemies by the late, great Walter Karp, who made that point throughout American history that American politics is driven by party establishments at the state level who would rather lose to the Democrats or the Republicans, the opposite party, than they would give up the machinery to an insurgency. And in that case, I think it tells you a lot of reasons why John Engler, but also, you know, Paul Cellucci and a lot of governors elsewhere in the country, having made their bet on George Bush, will stick with it. Last word, Bill Ballinger?
I think that's right. I mean, George W. Bush is somebody that John Engler and the Republican establishment feels very comfortable with, would like to get back in the driver's seat. But they have so much invested in his winning that at this point that's at least as important as whether George W. Bush actually wins or not.
Yeah, interesting. Bill Ballinger, very, very happy to make your acquaintance on The Connection. Thank you. We would love to talk to you again. Thank you, Robert Shogan, whose new book is called The Double-Edged Sword, How Character Makes and Ruins Presidents from Washington to Clinton. Thanks also to Bill Kristol of the Weekly Standard, who joined us in the first half of the hour. Thanks to the callers and the listeners. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
sets of The Connection are available for $15, including shipping and handling. To order, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and also by Legal Seafoods at Park Square across from the Theater District, now offering a late-night menu. If it isn't fresh, it isn't legal. On the web at legal.